The following podcast is intended for listeners over the age of 18. It contains mature subjects and adult discussion. Listener discretion is advised. As we are not doctors or psychologists, all advice is for novelty purposes only. All advice and discussion comes from our own personal experiences. Yours may well be different.
Welcome to the Swing Set. Climb on up. There's always a swing available. On Life on the Swing Set, the podcast, we explore open relationships and swinging. The pleasures and passions, the promise and pitfalls. We discuss all aspects of swinging in a fun, open, and welcoming fashion with a gleam in our eye, a bounce in our step, our hand down your pants. Ooh, sorry, got ahead of myself. We may be biased. In fact, we most certainly are. But we don't sugarcoat, and each of us speaks honestly and earnestly about our thoughts, ideas, and experiences throughout our very own lives on the swing set. Thanks for swinging by.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life on the Swing Set, the podcast. This is the first episode of our second season, and as a first episode special bonus, we are talking to Christopher Ryan, the author of Sex at Dawn. I'm Cooper Beckett. With me tonight, we have...
Hey, it's Ginger.
Hi, I'm the professor.
This is Shira B. Katz.
We are all here with Christopher Ryan. And it is a very early morning for us, but not for you, Mr. Ryan. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Congratulations on your second season.
Well, thank you. So I wanna start off by talking about bonobo porn. This was something I found fascinating, and I probably watched too much of it. As soon as I started reading about the bonobos, it was just like, oh, okay, they have sex like people. Yeah, okay, but how? People like are they really? And then when I found a video or two on YouTube, it is disturbingly human looking. It is disturbingly porn looking, the bonobo porn, just off the bat.
How disturbed are you?
I'm probably not as disturbed as I should be.
Cooper, this is the professor. Since I'm playing the role of Dylan today, I should be giving you a hard time for your bonobo porn fetish.
Noted. You've given me a hard time.
Do you suddenly have a hankering for partners wearing fur coats?
Very specific posing. Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, bonobo porn, you might know the book Bonobo Handshake by Vanessa Woods. Mm-hmm. She sent me some videos that I use in presentations that I give. And yeah, it's amazing. The face to face, the eye contact, the smiles, the laughing.
Well, and how quickly they slip in and out of it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like they'll really be walking next to each other, and then just, oh, we're gonna fuck for a minute, and then moving on.
Yeah.
Are there bad subplots as well? Is there a bonobo TV repairman?
He's here to fix the cable.
Right. Yeah,
the pizza delivery. And the males all wear black socks. It's amazing.
So for those of us who have never watched bonobo porn, can we elaborate as to what it actually is like?
Well, the bonobos are equidistant from us with chimpanzees. They're the two closest non-human primates to us by far. And in fact, chimps and bonobos are more closely related to us than they are to gorillas or orangutans or any of the other great apes. So we're so closely related that Jared Diamond, the well-known author of Guns, Germs, and Steel and other books, refers to chimps, humans, and bonobos as the three chimpanzees that we're, biologically speaking, it would be more parsimonious to categorize us as three subspecies of chimpanzee. But of course, the human ego doesn't allow that. But bonobos are very, very closely related to humans. And in terms of their sexuality, have many qualities in common with humans that virtually no other mammals have. For example, having sex face to face is something that we share with bonobos. All sorts of homosexual, same-sex interactions. The only interaction that's not permitted in bonobo society or just doesn't happen is mother-son. every other interaction that you can imagine takes place. And the sexuality is very casual, as Cooper said. The it's sort of like a way of greeting. It's a way of reconciliation. It's essentially like a handshake for humans, or, you know, a pat on the back or a high five or whatever you want to use. Frans de Waal, the great Dutch primatologist, said that chimpanzees use aggression to get sex, whereas bonobos use sex to avoid aggression.
And it's also fascinating in the book, the tap dance that the primatologists use to get away from the fact that we seem fairly like these animals. And if we would allow ourselves to be more like these animals, we might be a little more relaxed.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, that means powerful men giving up a little bit of power, though, which powerful men don't like to do, obviously, which is, I guess, what makes them powerful in the first place. But yeah, you find that in bonobo society, which is essentially female dominated, the males have much more sex than chimpanzees, for example, or other male dominated species, and have much lower stress in their daily lives. So the quality of life for a male bonobo is far better than it is for a male chimpanzee, which is sort of surprising given the fact that females dominate bonobo society. Bonobos are also very interesting in that they there's never been observed a single case of infanticide, murder, warfare, or rape among bonobos, whereas all of these things are quite common in chimpanzees and most other primates.
I think in reading the book and in listening and hearing what you're saying, there are so many parallels between that type of primate behavior and the swinger community. And Shira may also say the polyamorous community. Females really having a dominant role in driving and in negotiating arrangements, rules, etc., as well as males just generally being happier.
I would say the polyamorous community as a whole does somewhat have a female-driven subculture. However, I almost think it's more on equal grounds. However, on the same side, I could say even the monogamous communities, if you think about who controls the sex in most relationships, it's generally the female. The women are the ones saying no or yes, or you're allowed to or you're not allowed to.
Agreed. I think the difference there is that in, you know, mainstream monogamous, you know, monogamy myth culture, that it's an attitude of scarcity for those women, that we're going to shut it down as much as possible and maintain control that way, as opposed to certainly in, you know, the swinger world, that women own that and completely take control of their own sexuality and enjoy it for, you know, on its own, as their own sexuality, as opposed to something that's there to give to men or other partners. And so that kind of attitude of abundance really comes through, in that there's not this, I'm going to keep as much of this to myself as possible as my source of power, as opposed to, you know, I'm going to just enjoy my sexuality for what it is, enjoy myself, and then, you know, see what happens from there. So it's just a different paradigm there.
And Ginger, that reminds me of the part in the book that Christopher may have something to add, where we really talk about the difference in Western societies in really increasing the perceptive, you know, the role that sex has in people's minds, by saying that supply ends up getting restricted and demand is increased. The girls gone wild versus the girls, good girls don't, which makes, as a result, the sex seem like it's a bigger deal. How would you, Christopher, apply that to what you know about the lifestyle communities, swingers, polyamory, et cetera.
I agree that sex is often a female controlled resource, I guess we could say, even in the swinger community. But I think that as someone was saying earlier, I'm sorry, I get confused with who's talking.
That's okay. There are a lot of us, and we are ganging up on you here.
And you're all invisible. In the swinger community, I think the way it works is that there are certain rules, and if you follow those rules, you're in, and then you've got sexual abundance. Mm-hmm. But the minute you break a rule, you're out, you know. And single men aren't generally welcome in most swingers parties or clubs that I'm aware of. So you sort of have to be, you know, you have to have a woman who brings you and, you know, will vouch for you that you're not going to be a problem. But I wonder about whether sex is really a female controlled resource in most monogamous relationships, because it seems to me that female sexual frustration is a very big issue, and it's not talked about. But you know, in the chapter in the book where we talk about the war on masturbation and how so many women were seeing doctors for treatment for their hysteria in, you know, 19th and early 20th century England and America, mm-hmm. and you know, the invention of the vibrator and all that.
Yeah,
I think it's a huge issue, and I think that I don't have science to back this up, but my hunch is that a lot of the sort of chronic illnesses that women suffer from, particularly women, you know, 35, 40 and over, with long-term monogamous relationship that isn't sexually satisfying. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of those disorders don't relate to a lack of sexual fulfillment on their part because the men aren't interested.
I think in America in general, we're just sort of in this collective state of denial. Women want sex but aren't supposed to want sex, so therefore they try not to want sex. Men are supposed to want more sex, and so if they don't, they feel, you know, inadequate. You know, the whole country basically claims to be monogamous, yet very few are. And I loved the comment from U.S. and World Report that Americans spend more money at strip clubs than at Broadway, off-Broadway, regional, and nonprofit theaters, the opera, ballet, jazz, and classical music performances combined. You know, we're trying really hard to pretend we're better than sex as a country. We've almost defeated it.
We're beyond it.
Yes. And instead, you know, we're on the seedy underbelly. We're skirting around and doing these things and having affairs and seeing prostitutes and looking at porn, but we would never admit that this is possibly, you know, normal.
Yeah.
Or healthy even. But interestingly, exactly. I agree I hear what you're saying, Coop, about the seedy underbelly, but it's also, you know, the rock star celebrity lifestyle as well. So it's not just the underbelly. It's also oddly looking at these, you know, people who supposedly we want to be and their exciting affairs and who are they seeing now and, you know, which limo did they get in with whom and all of that. I mean, so it's very conflicted.
Here's the paradox. As we've talked about on the podcast, where sex is abundant, it generally is not the emphasis of most open relationships. And that ability to really help communicate, I mean, to help the vanilla world understand that open relationships really are not about the sex.
I think that happens, you know, for any a non-conventional relationship. You know, like everyone assumes that all homosexuals do all day is have sex, you know, running around trying to recruit children and so on. It seems to be the fantasy of the homophobes. And, you know, historically white people assume that all black people do is have sex all the time. You know, it seems like whoever is departs from the norm, they not only have sex differently, but they're obsessive about it. Whereas in fact, it's the so-called vanilla, the normal folks who are obsessive about it.
Well said.
Professor, did I answer your question?
You did. I think you pointed out well that, you know, when people are looking at the lifestyle community from the outside, they're projecting their own sense of importance of, you know, the role that sex plays, that it really is all about sex. When in fact, and to some extent, I think we, as we enter alternative lifestyles and rearrange our definitions of relationship, that is one of the major considerations that we think of. And I just think it's really ironic that after having now lived in that relationship construct for 4 years, that it really is much less about the sex. I'm just a, you know, a fat and happy bonobo right now.
Yeah, you know, I think it's like anything else. If, you know, food is a huge issue until you have enough food.
Right.
And it's not really a big deal anymore, you know. Shelter, the same thing, you know, protection, security, all these basic elements of life, oxygen, you know, we don't even think about it until suddenly there isn't enough. And I think sex is just another one of those. So it's counterintuitive to the sort of normal folks, but when sex isn't a restricted resource, it isn't such a problem.
And I thought in a very nerdy way that the description of the hunter-gatherer societies, the rise of agriculture, all of those things are just really good contextual examples, environmental examples, to bring it back to sex. And Ginger and I were laughing because I, after reading about 20 pages on how dental records help age people, I was wondering how you were going to bring this back to the central premise of the book. You did it well, by the way.
I came up with something, I guess. Yeah, that central section, you know, the non-sexual section, we had to sort of struggle with the editor to get them to agree to include that. They didn't want to include that in the book.
Why not?
Well, because it wasn't, you know, as you were implying, it's not directly relevant to the central premise of the book. It's not about, it's not sexual. And so they thought we'd lose a lot of readers in that section. But I just felt like, you know, even though it's not about sex, you can't isolate sex from other aspects of society. And intelligent readers would say, okay, how does this fit in, though? If they're all fighting wars all the time, if, you know, the males are dominant, if, you know, resources are restricted, how does it fit into that? And, you know, we're looking for intelligent readers, so we certainly don't want to leave them high and dry. But also, that information, I think, at least for me, is so interesting that, you know, I imagine that intelligent, curious readers will feel gratified just by knowing that our ancestors didn't die at 35, for example, typically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, to me, it's one of the same things that, you know, once you start pointing out fundamental flaws in existing thought process and belief, then it allows you to be more open on questioning the other fundamental this is true ideas from our past and all those areas. Because if you say, okay, you've believed this for all your life and here's why it might not be true, then immediately you get people, you'll get two camps. You get the ones who no, you're wrong completely, but you also get the, huh, if that's not true, then they're far more open to the other things you're going to show them.
Exactly. And that's why we started with the image of the Yucatan, how not knowing what we don't know is so pervasive in our thought process. And you know, getting back to the longevity and the diet and all that business, it's a package, you know? So it's kind of like you either accept the, you know, you accept the idea that the Earth is the center of the solar system. And if you accept that, then you have to accept all this other stuff in the pre-Copernican cosmology. But if you don't accept it, then you don't need to accept the rest of the package. You, as you said, you can start to question all the different elements because they're all interconnected. You know, they all form one worldview, this Hobbesian worldview, which, you know, as we say in the book, has a very profound political function, which is to make us believe that we're so lucky that we live in the here and the now.
I thought it was fascinating when you were talking about really studying beings, in this case, chimpanzees in their natural environment. And then I think the feeding, Shangan, when he was feeding, you know, really ended up seeing a very different behavior associated with those animals. I think I could speak on behalf of the swing set that we think that studying swingers would be far more interesting than chimps and South American tribes.
Yeah, and you can get right in there with the swingers. You don't need to just observe.
So in writing the sequel, I guess we're inviting you to come to a party.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Research purposes only, of course.
I assure you, swingers are just as fascinating as every one of those tribes you talk about.
As long as I can bring my clipboard.
we'd insist. Well, and you know what was really interesting to me is reading this, you know, and I've heard a lot of lifestyle people say the same thing, is that going through this, it's just like, yeah, that makes so much more sense, and yeah, that feels like something we already should have known. And you know, you're reading about these little tribes and the way they interact and how sex drives bonding amongst a group. And you look at then your swing relationships and how sex has, you know, helped bonding amongst a group, and how quickly you you feel closer to the people you're around, and how much more you're willing to do for them than, say, some of your more vanilla friends that you don't have that close, intense bond with. And it just makes so much sense how sex beyond the monogamous relationships would encourage mass bonding in any social group. And so it was reading through it, it's just like, wow, is this the manual for swingers?
Well, and just imagine if, you know, you're talking about people you get together with every couple of weeks probably, and you know, you share, maybe you share dinner and a couple of drinks and the sexual experiences and so on. But imagine if you also shared children.
Yeah.
You know, and you shared all your food and all your possessions, and you had like lived with each other your entire life, and you knew everyone's parents and brothers and sisters. And you know what I mean? It takes that intimacy that you're describing, which is already something that is that most of the swingers that I've spoken to find to be the best part of the lifestyle.
Absolutely.
I agree. I feel like in the polyamorous community, you see a little bit more of that, which is kind of funny. It makes it definitely a lot less interesting to grab your clipboard and come in and watch. it does tend to get a bit more tame once you start considering that non-monogamy. Once you do get past the resource starvation, you're not trying to control the sex because it's there freely and there's no scarcity. It can get very unsexy. And I wonder if that's part of why we put so much focus on the restrictions of sex, because once it's open and out there, you know, things like in the polyamorous community become about, okay, well, who's going to pay this bill and how are we going to raise these children and what are we going to do next? It becomes very domestic and much less sexy.
That's it. That sounds exactly like the type of issue you run into with monogamy, is once the intensity of the sex fades, then it's just about bill paying and raising the kids.
Yes, but then I would venture to that Christopher Ryan would say that we could do so in a much less stressful environment and maybe do it a little bit more productively and successfully if we let go of those controls.
Mm. Well, I agree that there's definitely sexuality is sort of, I think in the book we say it's like the steam engine a little bit, you know, like that the pressure builds naturally, and if it's released naturally, it doesn't really build all that high. But if it's contained in a steam engine and then sort of let out in little bursts of energy, you get civilization, essentially, you know, for better or worse. So there's definitely some something about the denial of natural expression of sexuality that can be sexy in a way. I mean, you know, you think about a nun and a priest getting together secretly at night out behind the church somewhere.
I'm thinking about it.
Wait, okay, now I'm there too. Okay, thank you.
So, I don't know. But I don't, personally, I don't think it's worth it. I think, I remember when Casilda and I were moving from Lisbon to Barcelona, and we were going around to grocery stores looking for boxes to pack our stuff up. And I remember thinking, you know, this is a great situation because here we really need these boxes. We really want them. And these supermarkets are happy to give them to us. That's what sex should be like. You know, there's a demand and there's no reason for it to be a big problem. It's another way to say it is like it's sex is like the solar energy of the psyche. You know, it's clean energy. It's I always think that, you know, it's this vitalizing energy. It keeps us young, it keeps us happy, it makes life fun, it's just all positive. And somehow we've turned away from that, and instead we're using carbon-based energy that causes all this mess.
And I think you quote in the book Sigmund Freud, who said that civilization was largely built, and I'm quoting, on erotic energy that was blocked, concentrated, accumulated, and redirected.
Yeah.
So I guess the converse of that then is if there is a tremendous release of erotic energy at your typical swinger party, it must represent the downfall of civilization.
Well, you know, I think that it sounds ridiculous, but I think that there is something to the fear of the, you know, right wingers, that unrestricted sexuality, is a fundamental threat to Western civilization. I think they're right about that in some ways, just like, similarly, they're scared to death of hallucinogens for the same reasons. You know, it makes no sense that LSD should carry a higher prison sentence than murder, but it does. And the only reason that I can figure for that is that, like alternative sexual practices, it can make you question the fundamental assumptions of Western society. And, you know, you might turn on, tune in, and drop out. And the same thing can happen sexually.
Yet at the same time, so many presidents we know have had documented affairs, or in the new book on the Roosevelt's marriage, Franklin and Eleanor, Extraordinary Marriage, you know, they really explore this idea of their open relationship, not sexually or not confirmed to be a sexually open relationship, but you know, if non-monogamy is okay for the leaders of the free world, then what's stopping everybody else?
Well, the fact that the leaders of the free world aren't openly challenging the normative principle of monogamy. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing it privately. Yeah. It's just like we all know, you know, the last several presidents have used marijuana, and they've even admitted it, sort of, but they still pretend it's wrong. You know, they use it, but they don't get up there and say, this is ridiculous. Why are we sending people to prison for this? I smoked it. It didn't hurt me.
That's
enough.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Didn't Obama almost lose all of his momentum when he admitted smoking marijuana on some MTV show?
Yeah.
Interview.
Right.
Yes, Christopher, you're in Denmark, is that correct?
No, I'm in Spain, in Barcelona.
You're in Spain. Okay, I apologize. That said, do you find that the culture and the politics around these issues, such as sex and drugs, is much more lenient, or do you have much of the same banter around it?
No, it's much more lenient. The Spanish approach to these matters is discretion is the operative principle. Both in sex and in drugs, it's a very different approach to law enforcement here. Every time I go back to the States, I've been here about 20 years based in Spain. Every time I go back to the States, I'm struck by how, military it feels.
Mm.
And I think the reason is that so many people, come out of the military and go into police work or airport security and things like that, that this sort of military mentality is very prevalent in the society. Whereas here, there's really, the Spanish army is kind of a joke. There's no, you know, they're not really, I mean, I think they've got like 100 people in Afghanistan or something, and they're all medics and truck drivers. It's not a militaristic society at all. Police aren't oppositional. They're not looking to arrest people. They're actually trying to avoid problems. So they'd much rather that there not be a problem than that they have to get involved in it. So consequently, as far as drugs go, marijuana is completely legal. The only thing that's illegal is trafficking. So if you're growing marijuana in your backyard, as long as you're not growing a plantation, nobody cares. And even if you have 10, 15 plants, unless your neighbors complain, nobody cares. There are no helicopter flights. There's no, you know, nobody is really interested. It doesn't matter. And it's the same with sexuality. There are lots of swingers clubs here. In fact, it's said that Barcelona is second only to Amsterdam in the amount of sex-related commerce of all European cities. Prostitution is tolerated as long as organized crime isn't involved. And again, the neighbors don't complain. And there are probably 30 swingers clubs in Barcelona. And, you know, alcohol is allowed, and it's all pretty laid back as far as sexuality and drugs go. If you're not bothering anybody, nobody's looking to bother you either.
So swing set trip to Barcelona.
I was just about to say, Cooper, we're going to rethink that next gathering. And I'm definitely
It sounds better than Vegas.
It's way better than Vegas.
Absolutely.
I've only been to Vegas once, but I was invited to speak at the lifestyle conference there, probably in 2003, maybe four. And, that was pretty amazing, you know, to see how strictly separate alcohol was from any sort of sexual activity. They couldn't be in the same place. And I was being interviewed by, a film crew were doing a documentary, and they interviewed me in one of the hallways standing in front of a plant or something. And I was talking about bonobos and, you know, science. I wasn't saying anything racy at all, but security came out and shut the whole thing down because I was talking about sex, and you couldn't do that in a public area.
Oh, wow.
Barcelona certainly sounds refreshing. Where were you raised, Christopher?
I lived in a lot of different places growing up, but mostly on the East Coast, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and upstate New York.
That's a big culture change. What do you think it is about, I guess, your career or your upbringing that brought you to actually get so interested in things as our sexual background as a human species, or just to become an author of such a magnificent book?
Well, that, you know, that's the kind of question I should have a short, pithy answer to, but I'm afraid. My life has been very, I don't know what the word is. I mean, when I finished college in 1984, undergrad, and I swore to myself that I would spend the next 10 to 15 years just floating around the world. not committing myself to graduate school or a career or a woman or anything else. And essentially I spent probably the next 20 years just backpacking around the world till I ran out of money, and then, you know, getting whatever interesting job I could find and save up some more money and then keep going. And so I, you know, worked on fishing boats in Alaska. I taught self-defense in Mexico. I managed real estate in Midtown Manhattan. I taught English to prostitutes in Bangkok. I did all sorts of weird stuff. And the whole time I was sort of
interested. And now you're a crusader for sexuality.
So yeah, I wasn't getting laid very often, though, I'm sorry to say. That was, you know, I was too busy traveling around, so I didn't have a lot of deep relationships with women. And a couple times I traveled with a girlfriend, but that changed the experience too much. So maybe, you know, maybe that's the answer to your question, that in my 20s I was probably pretty sexually frustrated because I was sacrificing relationships in order to travel. And at the same time, I was focused on what it was that people from all these different cultures had in common, what they shared and what was different. And so I was always trying to tease out what is human from what is cultural or individual. And so I guess that's the common thread that runs through my first sort of intellectual passion as a child was American Indians. Mm-hmm. And there were probably 4 years where that's all I cared about. I read every book I could find. I sewed my own moccasins. I had a wigwam in the backyard. I, you know, was lurking around the neighborhood in a loincloth. Yeah, which must have been kind of strange for the neighbors, because I'm like very pale and have red hair, and I don't look like anything again. But you know, that was sort of just came to me naturally. I just had this very deep passion for Native American cultures, and I felt estranged from my own culture reading all that. But then later, the first research that I did, serious research and publishing, was about consciousness, altered states of consciousness, and the way that various societies use sacred plants ritualistically, which relates to what I was saying earlier about LSD and that sort of thing. And then sex. And, you know, so there it is. Consciousness and sexuality are these two very deep experiences that all human beings share. And yet we experience them in very different ways.
How would you characterize, I don't recall in the book hearing or reading anything around the Native American constructs of sexuality. How would you characterize their approach to sexuality?
Well, it's very dangerous to talk about any sort of Native American commonality, because there's so many different cultures,
sure.
You know. So we talk about, I think we mentioned a few. We mentioned the Comanches. The women, Comanche women, were apparently famous for being sexually aggressive and very assertive. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I've been looking into accounts of white women who were either captured or as children or even as adults and taken to live with Native Americans. It's very interesting that if they'd been there for more than a few months, they almost always chose to stay, even when they had chances to go back to white society. Or in fact, when they were rescued by white soldiers, there are several cases of women who, you know, were brought back to the village, and, you know, everyone cried and welcomed them back. And next thing you know, they like threw off their clothes and wandered back, you know, mm-hmm. found their way back to the village.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. They had much higher status. They had, you know, from their own accounts, they had much much more satisfying relationships with the Indians than they did with their own people.
When I hear you talk about this kind of collision of the, you know, innate human behavior and culture, that's when I start to really get fired up, because I just think that that is there. It's just so rich with so much to talk about. And one thing, I have so many questions. One thing I wanted to share with you, Christopher, is in discussions with friends, recommending, Sex at Dawn and saying, read it, read it, read it. And then having these discussions after the fact, I have had more than one friend bringing it down to a personal level and the impact of what you have put forth in the book, where they literally are having a moment in life where they're like, oh, it's not me. This is my just instinct, my how I want to live my life as opposed to how I feel like I should live my life. It has been in such conflict, but reading Sex at Dawn has just flipped a switch for them. And they feel for the first time like there's nothing wrong with them, because they feel more in alignment with what you've put forth in the book, that they have never felt that the cultural, American cultural construct of monogamy and partnering with one person for life makes sense for them or works for them or makes them happy, or, you know, their descriptions of their experience has varied, but has all kind of come down to that. I'm just curious to hear from you if you've had any other, heard from any other people who've been affected personally by the premise of the book.
Yeah. We probably get at this point 5 to 10 emails a week from people telling us something like that, and it's sort of slowed down a little bit. The first few months we were getting 20 to 30 emails a week from people like that. It's just unbelievable. You know, as I said earlier, this is the only book I've ever, Casilda or I have ever published. So this is all new to us. Mm-hmm. But it's just so incredibly gratifying to get emails from people saying exactly what you just said, that, you know, I feel liberated. I feel healthy. I thought it was just me. And now I understand it's not just me. And also from couples, you know, saying, you know, my husband and I have talked about this book, and now we understand that, you know, it's not that our marriage is okay. It's, you know, the fact that we don't have so much sex anymore isn't because I'm ugly or he's ugly or, you know, there's something wrong with us. It's just that we're Homo sapiens, and thank you for showing us that.
Right.
I think probably the most moving email, or at least the one that sticks in my mind because it's so short. It was just a couple sentences. She said, "I'm a 63-year-old widow. This is the most important book I've ever read. I wish I could live my life over."
Wow. Wow.
Well, we spent a lot of time talking to Christopher Ryan that morning, and we're going to split it here, and we'll bring it back again next week for the second part of our interview with Christopher Ryan, author of Sex at Dawn. Thanks, as always, for listening. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/theswingset. You can follow us on Twitter at swingsetlife. Email us, contact@lifeontheswingset.com. Give us a call at 573-55-SWING. That's 573-557-9464. If you have any questions, concerns, or need any advice, or would like to correct us, or would like to yell at us for being heathens, anything you'd like to do, we always welcome your input and questions. So catch you next time on the Life on the Swing Set, the podcast, as we continue our interview with Christopher Ryan. Thanks, as always, for swinging by. Get ready, swing setters. We are firing up another Life on the Swing Set sex toy contest.
When was the last time you fell in love with a vibrator? Well, let me tell you, every time Marilyn picks up her Lilo Ina, she falls in love all over again. Lilo's twist on the classic rabbit allows you to have two independent vibrators, one on your clit and one on your G-spot. It's made out of incredibly soft silicone and has the widest variety of speed and pulse settings we have ever encountered. While many vibrators say they're whisper quiet, this one actually is. So how can you get this amazing vibrator? Well, let me tell you. All you have to do is give us a call and leave us a sexy message that gets us hot and bothered. It can be an orgasm, a sexy story, whatever your heart and loins desire. So give us a call at 573-55-SWING. That's 573-557-9464. And be a little naughty on our voicemail for your chance to win the fabulous Lilo Ina.